Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and this is a continuation in our series that I'm tentatively calling How We Invented the Internet. And by we, I mean all the people, and there were thousands of them, who in the very early days put in incredible time, effort, and imagination into figuring out how to transition the Internet from literally a network where commerce was banned. I think that might be news to some people, especially younger people. It was actually prohibited to engage in commercial activity on the Internet. And then the government changed its mind and flipped the switch. The problem was everybody on the Internet up to that point was really not in a commercial mindset of any kind. So there was a little bit of a lapse. And that lapse basically took place between 1993 and 1995. And a lot of people got involved in trying to figure it out because, believe it or not, there was a time when the vast majority of people that considered the issue felt the Internet had no real commercial potential at all. And that includes people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Larry Ellison. If you're a good detective and a good historian and go way back and find the hidden papers, all those guys were not enthusiastic about the Internet as a commercial medium. That might have had to do with the fact that it was going to change their business model if it did become a commercial medium. But nonetheless, the leadership did not come from Microsoft or Apple or any of those places. It came from people just trying to figure out. And we have one of them on the line with us today, Rick Boyce. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, Ken. Thank you. Glad to be here.
And, you know, everybody knows that the Internet has advertising on it and mega behemoths. Juggernaut companies like Facebook and Google, as glamorous as they are essentially nothing much more than advertising platforms. People click on ads and people get paid for that. And there was a time when that didn't exist. And the whole idea of clicking on an ad and companies buying ads on the Internet was, you know, was kind of unthinkable. And Rick is one of the key people who said, hey, let's put ads on the Internet and sell them. And that became and still is the foundation for everything that you see on the Internet today. Without that transition, we would not have a commercial Internet. So we're going to talk with Rick about those years. But first, I want to get some background on him. I've known Rick for at least 25 years. It's hard to believe that that much time could pass, but it's been 25 years. And there's a lot of things I don't know about him. Like, Rick, where were you born?
That's great. It has been a little bit more than 25 years, Ken. I know, it's amazing, and we'll get into that meeting. I suspect a little bit later, but I was actually born in Janesville, Wisconsin, but shortly thereafter, I wasn't there long. I moved to Seattle, so I've been a West Coaster since I was about 6 months old, and following my time in the Northwest, made my way to San Francisco, and that's really where I began my career in my early 20s.
And where did you go to college?
I went to Washington State University, and the reason I went there was because they have a great communications college called the Murrow College of Communication, Edward R. Murrow being their most famous graduate. So that's where I learned a little bit about advertising and communications and fell in love with the whole thing. So I was there in the early 80s, and then upon finishing that up, moved to San Francisco and started working for an ad agency.
Two questions. What made you decide to become a communications major? And then what drew you to San Francisco?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the second question first. My dad lived in San Francisco, and my brothers and I had been visiting him from the Northwest for quite a number of years and just really fell in love with the place. We couldn't believe that there was this amazing place called California where it didn't rain all the time. We're from Seattle. And so that was so I think the weather was a big draw, to be honest. Because back when we were kids, there was no Gore-Tex or anything like that, so we just kind of got wet to the bone. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be cool to live in some place where I don't have to get soaked every day? So that was a part of it, believe it or not. But yeah, communications and advertising, I think I was just always fascinated by media, and I loved media's ability to attract attention, accumulate audiences. And for me, commercial communication, whether it be PR or advertising, was always particularly interesting, and I love the idea that companies and brands could influence the conversation through commercial communication. So I just found that super interesting. And at a young age, and I'm not quite sure why beyond that, but I'm happy I did because I still love the field today.
So that's great. You're one of those rare people that knew what they were doing in college.
Isn't that funny? I know my wife says that all the time too. She says, "You're the only person I know who actually ended up doing what they studied in college." Yeah, exactly. I even worked for the school newspaper and sold ads, you know, so that was, that began pretty early. Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised, and I find this in my life, I wouldn't be surprised if it's true for you, that was some of the most important training you ever got.
It really was. Yeah, it really was. I loved working for the school newspaper and selling ads to local merchants and you know, seeing them get a benefit from those ads and from the exposure. And, you know, that was kind of my first taste of, wow, this stuff can really work.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. Interesting. Now I'm seeing how this all evolved then. So you found yourself in, compared to Seattle, balmy San Francisco.
Yes.
I just got to tell a funny story about your part of the world. I went to Vancouver once and I was in the airport and they had a vending machine for umbrellas. And I thought, this is a joke. This can't be real. And I was in Vancouver for a week. I think I saw the sun for maybe an hour and a half in 7 day period. So folks that think Rick is exaggerating, I'm here to testify that when it's rainy season in the Pacific Northwest, it's really, really coming down. So San Francisco, you got there in the early 80s or late 80s?
Yeah, 1984.
Okay.
And yeah, kicked off with an internship at a little agency called Cunningham & Walsh that has since been absorbed through the, you know, massive consolidation of ad agencies. But that was a great start. I wasn't paid, but I got great experience there. And from that little shop, I transitioned to an agency in San Francisco, a little bit bigger, called Ketchum Advertising, and worked there for a few years, and then transitioned over to Hal Reiney and Partners, where I spent the next 7 or 8 years really developing out my career as a media professional.
Now, Hal Reiney was, and I imagine still is, unless it's been acquired, I'm not up to date, a really hot shop.
Yeah, super hot back then. The whole, you know, San Francisco market was really regarded as, you know, one of the hottest creative cities in the nation. And Hal Reiney and Partners does still exist. It's owned by Publicis now, so it's part of a larger holding company, as almost every agency in the world now is. But yeah, back then, certainly regarded as one of the top creative shops in the country. And we really started to establish a couple of trends while at the agency. And one big one was, we started to attract clients that were interested in our services from outside of the San Francisco area. And I think prior to that, that was far less common. Most often, brands would hire agencies that were local and you know, relatively close to their headquarters. That really changed with Hal Reiney and Partners, for certain. And you know, many of our clients were from all over the country, but really looking for the cutting edge type of creative work that was coming out of San Francisco at that time.
How did you start at Hal Reiney? What were you doing at first?
Yeah, I started as a media planner. And when I left there 7 or 8 years later, I was a vice president, associate media director. So really, you know, grew there professionally and grew in my knowledge, you know, with media. But worked on accounts initially, like the California Prune Board, which was actually a super interesting account. You wouldn't think so. Worked on Perrier and a number of Perrier brands, Stroh Brewery. Worked on Saturn. General Motors launched the Saturn in the mid-80s, and that was a huge deal that Reiney won that account and really helped launch that, you know, brand new car. It was a different kind of company, different kind of car, if you remember the tagline from back in the day. So worked on that, worked on Alamo Rent-A-Car, and a number of other things. So did just so many great brands, you know, there at that time. It was work on Gallo Winery, a little bit of Bartles and James, for example. I mean, if you think about it, the brands that they were working on at the time were really iconic with campaigns that were just amazing.
Was the California Prunes the dancing prunes? I heard it through the grapevine.
I think you're thinking of the dancing. Yeah, you're thinking of the dancing
raisins. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Raisins dance. I'm not sure what prunes do, but but it was fun. It was really fun, nevertheless. I mean, it's interesting to work on an account that, at first blush, is not very interesting or doesn't sound interesting, and you know, there's always creativity to be discovered, you know, inside of any advertising campaign, and certainly had a lot of that, even with the Prune Board.
Well, that's the challenge. And, of course, you know, that's a huge industry, agriculture, for California.
Absolutely.
They think California is all Hollywood and tech, but agriculture is a huge part of the economy there and in the country. Hey, for people that don't know what a media planner is, what does a media planner do at an ad agency?
Yeah, media planning, and at the time, I think it was – considered a relatively unglamorous job. I think these days that's changed a lot, because what's been recognized throughout the industry is that the vast majority of dollars that get spent on advertising aren't actually spent on the creative development, although that's not insignificant, but most of the money is spent on media placement and actually buying the inventory where the advertising appears. So a media planner will work within a client's budget to identify the best places to advertise to reach whatever the desired target audience or target audiences are for a particular brand or a particular campaign. So typically a media planner will have expertise across every media type imaginable. So that includes television, out of home, radio, print advertising, be that newspaper or magazines, and certainly for the last 25 years, digital, which has become, you know, a key arrow in the quiver of any media planner. So it's a super interesting job because you have to have this vast knowledge of all these different potential media outlets and their pros and cons of each in terms of reaching different audiences, and then putting together a plan that uses typically some combination of these media tools to effectively reach and influence the target audience. So it's definitely one of those art plus science type careers, mm-hmm. which I think makes it, you know, always interesting and super fun. Every client's different, every campaign's different. It's a super interesting and super challenging career path, that's for sure.
Gotcha. So if for people that have never thought about it, it's not just enough to create, you know, clever ads and attention getting ads. You also have to figure out where to put them so the right people see them.
Yeah.
And it's as creative as creating the ad in a sense, because, you know, you have to know where the people are. And sometimes you discover places that might not have been initially obvious. So one of the things that I learned that you did later, many years later, as I was reading some biographical material about you, that there was some kind of a committee or a working group at Hal Reiney on digital media that you were a member of. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, definitely. I was fortunate to work for a brilliant media director there named David Verklin, who is a friend and certainly was a great mentor of mine during my time there. And David noticed that I had a particular interest in the future. I was always, I think, a little bored in media by kind of what had always been done and was most interested in what had not been done but probably made sense. And so, I mean, just to give you one example, I identified for a number of our clients pretty early on that we were missing a large part of our potential consumer base by not using Spanish language media in certain markets that were particularly important for some of the brands that we work on. In particular, this included the Perrier group of bottled waters. So, you know, in many cases, we had significant sales in L.A., Miami, markets like that. And so just by way of example, I brought a number of those brands into Spanish language media for the first time because I thought it was important. And it turned out that was the case. And that was, you know, 30 years ago. It wasn't nearly as mainstream as it is now. But so David just recognized that I was always looking for that next interesting thing or that next interesting way to reach audiences that maybe we weren't reaching at the time. So he asked me if I would be in charge of this very informal group that we call the Media Futures Unit. And the role of the Media Futures Unit was just to look into the future as best we could and try to decipher what's going to come next in terms of media. And the idea was that this would be a presentation that we'd share with our clients just to remind them that we're forward-thinking and always kind of pushing the envelope in terms of identifying what's next and what might be something that makes sense for them on a future media plan.
Gotcha. I remember the first time that I saw you and then we met was at a conference sponsored by Simba, which I don't know if Simba's still in business. And interestingly enough, the subject was the Yellow Pages. I don't even know how I ended up at that conference. It might have been couched as the future of the Yellow Pages or something like that. I don't know. And I thought, well, I'll just go and check it out. And you gave a fascinating talk about what's the reality going to be when we have 500 channels? Because at that point, I don't think we had 500 channels. And 500 channels was something projected into the future. And as a media planner, you were raising the issue of how are we going to deal with that? Because it's a lot more complicated to have 500 channels than the number of channels we have now. How are we going to manage all these different media outlets? It's a long time since you gave that talk. Do you remember the talk?
I do. Yeah, I remember the talk, and I remember meeting you there, and I remember meeting some of the folks from Simba and whatnot. And I know that following that, we kind of formed an informal community, a group that got together multiple times, you know, at your place, and we even had some meetings in New York with the Simba folks afterwards. But that turned out to be a very important conference for me to be at, because I met people like you and others who were definitely thinking about the future and thought or knew that something was about to happen, although none of us could quite articulate what that was going to be, that's for certain. And I know that I think back on my comments at the time, I think most of what I was talking about was television related and more about the future of television and the fragmentation of, or the further fragmentation of the television viewing through, you know, additional programming and additional networks that were certainly going to come on board. And I think to the extent my presentation addressed online, it was probably a token slide or two about America Online or Prodigy or something like that. But it was only through that meeting that through talking to you and others there that my lens really widened to see that it wasn't just about the future of television, but it was the future of online was probably going to be equally or as more important. And so that was super eye-opening. And it was interesting too, because shortly thereafter, as it seemed like two camps. So that conference, I think, was in 1983 and kind of, or 93, sorry.
93, yeah.
That was 93, I would guess. And then by kind of 94, it kind of seemed like two camps were kind of starting to set up. There were the kind of the web believers, and then there were the, you know, interactive TV believers, and kind of both were parallel pathing. And it just wasn't really clear to me, at least in early 94, which was going to be the which was kind of going to win. Not that anyone had to win, but it was kind of interesting. And I think that those of us in media kind of had to think, should I bet my future on and kind of take a job in the, you know, kind of in the online space, or should I kind of look to what's happening in the TV space? I mean, clearly there was, you know, something super interesting happening, you know, in both camps. So it's something I certainly thought a lot about at that time, but I was happy to have met you and kind of helped nudge me towards the world of online.
And give some perspective on that. I organized a conference in November of 94, and to give some people a vision of what was going on back then, San Francisco was a hotbed of what was then called multimedia development. And this was before the commercial CD-ROM. And just as the commercial CD-ROM was finally making it into stores, before that, everything was handmade. So IBM would say, hey, we need an interactive laser disc that demonstrates our latest something or other, right? And then guys would go off and make this one-off handmade, you know, interactive presentation. And so there was quite an industry of that in San Francisco in the early 90s. And when I went around to those folks and said, hey, I think this internet thing is going to be useful, only 50% were receptive, and the other half were not receptive. They couldn't imagine, well, how are we going to fit all these pictures and videos and audios and everything online? Because in those days, for young people, for perspective, you had these modems that were were pretty slow. I can remember seeing the first graphic on the web the first time I saw one, and it took about 5 minutes for it to paint itself in on the page. It didn't seem ready for prime time. Just to give people perspectives, there really was a very strong divide. The multimedia people tended to be a little more commercially minded, and the online people tended to be more idealistically minded. They really weren't business people. They were more computer people that had come out of the pre-commercial phase of the internet. They were excited and they had ideas about opening it up to the whole world and getting everybody on it, but they didn't have many ideas about how to market it. Whereas the multimedia people, they were already selling their services to, you know, IBM and Saturn and big companies. So that was the landscape that Rick's talking about.
Yeah.
So you were really important in my evolution too, because I was trying to find, I had this sense that something was going to happen and that advertising was had to be an essential element of it, but I couldn't visualize how it was going to happen. I remember going to your office and you pulled down the standard and rate book. Is that what it's called? The standard data and rate?
Yeah, the SRDS, standard rate and data services, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So there's one for TV, one for radio, one for direct mail. And then there was one for miscellaneous. And I'll never forget, you brought the miscellaneous one off the shelf and said, maybe the internet could go in this book.
Yeah, and I think and it did for a while. They did. There was an SRDS for digital for a while. Yeah, I don't think it was long lasting, but yeah, it did happen.
Yeah. So that was our best guess at the time, and then we had an interesting meeting at Henry Dakin. Henry Dakin's not a very well known guy, but he really should be. He had this. He's from the Dakin toy family, and he bought this beautiful Art Deco garage in Pacific Heights and turned it into a conference center, and Apple used it for their multimedia development center when pre-CD-ROM and the SOVAM teleport, which connected the Soviet Union to the United States via the internet. All these really far-seeking projects took place in that building, and Henry lent me the conference space to have a meeting, and Rick, you attended, and Mark Graham, who at that time was known as Mr. Internet in Silicon Valley. And it wasn't necessarily an honorific. It was just sort of he's the crazy internet guy. And we all met, and that was, I think, in June. Now, pretty shortly thereafter, you hooked up with Hotwired, which was a division of Wired Magazine. How did that take place?
Yeah, that connection did happen in the summer of 94. And, you know, the way that had happened was oftentimes at the agency, we would have media companies come in, and you know, we would gather as a group and as a media department, and they would share with us basically their capabilities. So it's kind of a chance for them to share with us what they were doing and you know, why it might be relevant to us, and we would share a bit about, you know, our accounts and our projects that we're currently working on, and kind of it'd be an active brainstorming and sharing session. So the team from Wired came in, and we were, you know, at the time, so if you think about the summer of 94, Wired Magazine had been around about 18 months. And, you know, the magazine, which when it first came out in early 93, certainly made a splash. They used metallic inks, fluorescent inks, you know, just these far out articles about the future and how technology was going to affect all of our lives. And the magazine felt like it came from Mars or something. It was just the most amazing experience. I think everybody at that time who was in San Francisco around media or around technology was just pretty blown away by this magazine that somehow arrived in their mailbox. And so we were super interested at the agency in learning more about Wired, and you know, not only as an advertising vehicle, which we certainly were very interested in, because we thought the audience they were reaching was very, very unique. But also we wanted their insights. Like, tell us more about what you guys are talking about in every issue. You know, tell us more about this digital revolution that you're talking about and what the implications might be. So we were super interested in hearing from them. So they came in and they did a great presentation about the magazine. And then something unexpected happened, probably the last half of the meeting. They said, well, you know, we've talked about the magazine. Now we want to share with you a little bit about what our online plans are. And now we're really leaning forward. We're going, okay, we'd love to hear this. And they said, well, you know, there's this thing called the World Wide Web. And they went through basically that introduction and that setup. And then they proceeded to show us a demo of what their website would look like and what the ads would look like. And these, you know, banner ads included on these pages. And they talked to us about how those would be hyperlinked and those would link through to a destination of the advertiser's choice and whatnot. So we were, and they showed us some video and obviously it was image rich, you know, in addition to text. And so it was just really blew our minds. And at the end of that meeting, the ad director for Wired Magazine, her name's Dana Lyon, and Dana had been a good friend for many, many years. I'd known her through the industry. And she mentioned to me that they were looking for a sales leader to oversee and be in charge of the advertising sales for Hotwired, this website that they were going to be launching in October of 1994. And so she, you know, asked that innocent question of, you know, hey, by chance, Rick, do you know anybody who might be interested in doing a job like that for us? And so I told her I would think about it and see if anyone came to mind. And probably about 2 hours later, I called her up and I said, all right, I thought about it. That's going to be me. I want to do that.
Wow.
That was kind of how that began. And it was fortunate, as I mentioned, I'd known her for a long time and had a lot of mutual trust. And I think she was certainly interested in having a partner come on board who could really help her take this media company. I mean, this was a company with huge ambitions, and the magazine was just going to be the beginning. And I think that what they all realized was that they were going to have to really build out a team to really achieve the media ambitions that they had. And so I think she was, super happy that I was interested. And, shortly thereafter, she introduced me to Louis Rossetto and Jane Metcalf, who are the husband and wife team that founded Wired, and we hit it off and met the CEO of Hotwired, Andrew Anker, at the time, and we hit it off. So it wasn't that long after that they offered me the job, and I was super excited to join them. So I think that was around early September then of 94 that I finally came on board with them, and we launched Hotwired on October 27th of that year, so 25 years ago this month. And that was quite a sprint. So I'd say from basically Labor Day up to launch, it was a high speed sprint to sell the ads, which we did, and to get it launched on time and sold out with a number of very, very blue chip customers.
Something that didn't mention, but I think is really important, that was, believe it or not, folks, the first time a serious company said, we are going to build a financially self-sustaining and hopefully profitable online thing. publication. I don't think anybody, I mean, there was Global Net Navigator, and that was a project of O'Reilly, and they did have, some ads and so on, but it was sort of a sideline. They weren't trying to make a business out of the website. It was something they almost wanted to do as a demo to show how the web could work. Whereas with Wired and Hotwired, this was, no, we're going to have an office, we're going to have staff, we're going to have Rick Boyce leading the sales effort. This is going to be for grown, this is a grown-up activity. We're all in. They were all in, basically.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Wired had had a digital presence on the online services, at the time, and that was going to continue. But, if you go back to, I think it was December of 93, that's when the first Mosaic browser came out for Windows at about that time. Mm-hmm. That might have even been the beta version. The Mac version, I don't think, came out until, mid or even late 94. But it really was the browser that had really kind of presented itself shortly before that made the possibility of the web, visible to the pioneers anyway. And so for the founders, Jane and Lewis, and certainly Andrew at Wired and Hotwired, the browser made it clear that they could present things, online that would be, as interesting, if not more interesting, than what they were sharing in the pages of the magazine every month. And, at the time, you might remember, Ken, I think the predominant browser before Mosaic was called Lynx, L-Y-N-X, and that was text only. And so early browsing was a text-only experience, and it was only with the Mosaic browser where the multimedia capabilities all of a sudden became clear. And that's what the execs at Wired saw very early on and said, okay, we're going to do this. And so that was their next step in digital beyond the online services was obviously, the web.
And to give people a timeline on how fast Hotwired was out of the gate on this, the company that commercialized the web browser, because there were a variety, Lynx was one of them, there was one called Opera, there were a bunch of, browsers floating around. But again, the first company that stuck the flag in the ground and said, no, we're going to be a browser server company, that was Netscape, which in those days was called the Mosaic Communications Corporation. They didn't get founded as a company until April of 1994. So
yeah, that would
the
make
fact
sense.
That, yeah, so the fact, and I know Mark graduated from college kind of midterm. He graduated at the end of 93, and then he moved to Silicon Valley, where he got a very modest job. Nobody was terribly interested in talking with him about anything, even though he had a million users on a piece of software that he developed. And it was only because Jim Clark had been bounced out of Silicon Graphics, which was a company he founded, and was looking for a new game to play, that he heard about Mark, and they met, and they talked quite a bit, and they went into business together, and it was April 1994. So not many months later, the Hotwired is saying, we're going to build a whole publication out of this, and we're going to hire professionals to run it, and it's going to be run like a business. It's not going to be a hobby or a demo project. So it was the first. I just want to emphasize that for people. Wrap your minds around that. There are now, I don't know, 100 billion websites. Many of them are commercial. The first commercial website where all the players were all in and intending to make it into a business was Hotwired. And it's interesting, Rick, you were able to call on your college experience of selling ads.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Bringing it all back. And, you know, it's really common for people who start out in a media planner type position at the agency to, you know, someday, you know, usually after they develop a bit of experience, you know, to kind of cut over to the sales side. So if you think about it, it's kind of the same conversation just from, you know, from the other side of the table. So it wasn't that uncommon for media people to move into sales roles. It was just, in my case, you know, nothing else had been interesting up until this point. So whether it be print or broadcast or otherwise, none of that was interesting enough to bring me over to the sales side. But what it really took was online to really create that interest.
Gotcha. Now, I know that in the early months of Netscape, which was, they changed their name in November of 94, but from the time they founded in April to November, they were called Mosaic Communications Corporation. So I'm going to refer to them as Mosaic Communications.
Okay.
They had a tough time generating interest in what they were doing. It was not easy. I think Mark's still a little... He's still smarting a little bit from some of the treatment that he and Jim got when they went around trying to pitch their ideas to the world. What did you encounter? It sounds like you got geared up super fast and of course, super early. And you, how did it go? Who signed on? Who were the first people to say, yeah, we'll give this a try? Early advertisers?
Well, yeah. I mean, like any technology, you know, I have no doubt that if we went back and looked at how our business, you know, developed, you know, it followed that traditional, you know, trajectory, you know, kind of beginning with, you know, the early adopters you know, then onto early mainstream. And then, of course, you know, we had to cross the chasm. You might remember that book and that reference. But
oh, yeah.
So it was really about finding the early adopters, and they were out there. And in the world of media and advertising, if you think about it, like people who are attracted to advertising are, you know, I think almost all, you know, inherently creative, inherently curious. And, you know, our job was really to find, you know, the true early adopters, kind of the super curious among that universe of what was naturally pretty curious people. And so that's what we followed, and it actually worked out really well. And you know, the magazine and the website were really presented in conjunction by our sales team. And at that time, we had a group of excellent salespeople who were representing the magazine in the marketplace. And then they were also talking to customers about Hotwired. And so if you think about that meeting I described earlier that happened at Hal Reiney and Partners, where the magazine was discussed and then Hotwired was introduced, mm-hmm. those were happening all over the country, particularly in major media centers like New York, San Francisco, LA, Chicago. And so through that process, we were starting to discover who the early adopters were and who these super curious people, particularly curious about the world of digital, were. So, for example, we found a young man named Stephen Comfort at an agency in New York City called, are you ready? Mesner, Viteri, uh-huh. Berger, McNamee, Schmetterer. And so at that agency, that's the name. I think it was the MBBMS. Yeah. So at that particular agency, Stephen was a media planner, and he had probably a designation as a kind of new media kind of guy. So he was on the lookout for kind of what was new and what was happening. And so we were fortunate enough to meet Stephen pretty early on. And he was our biggest single buyer at the launch of Hotwired. He brought four campaigns from his agency onto Hotwired. Two were from MCI. MCI was a giant telecommunications company at that time. And he also brought Volvo on board and also Club Med. So, you know, three really great brands, three great brands, four campaigns total, came from Stephen Comfort. So he was a one of our key early adopters. A year or so later, as you might not be surprised, we hired him, and he came and joined our team. So, and he's gone on to do lots of interesting things in the Valley. Another kind of mega buyer, although not quite as big as Stephen was the folks at Moda Media. And so this agency had been formed to focus on digital and online specifically, called Moda Media. I hadn't really heard of them. I think initially they might have called us, to tell you the truth. But they also brought a couple of campaigns on board. One was from AT&T, and the other was from Zima, which was a beverage, an alcoholic beverage that came from the Adolf Coors Brewing Company at that time.
Was that like a beer that was transparent?
Yes, it was clear.
Clear beer. Okay.
That was right. It was a clear beer, and I think at the time they called them New Age beverages, and that was an evolution of the wine cooler industry, which had kind of these sweeter, low alcohol being kind of roughly what beer was. Kind of drinks were pretty popular at the time. So I think it was an evolution from the wine cooler segment, which was super hot. I mean, looking back, none of us can believe it now, but that was super hot at that time.
I remember. And
yeah.
was Saturn an early advertiser?
Yeah, they were really early. Yeah, they weren't one of the initial 12, but they came on board very shortly thereafter. They joined us. A couple of the other, and at that point too, it was kind of a number of the advertisers weren't able. I can't remember if this was Saturn's situation, but a lot of them weren't quite able to start when we were ready, because their web destination wasn't quite ready to go. And so there was a lot of coordination at that time between, the ad and where it was going to link to. It was so early that many of these advertisers didn't have websites yet, so they really didn't maybe know where this was going to link to, and those were developed in short order, of course. Or in other cases, their internet presence was probably more business-to-business than consumer-focused. And so, even if they were on the web, and some of those companies, like one of our early sponsors at launch was IBM, and they had a significant web presence at the time, which is remarkable given, how early that was. But they created something completely special and unique for the destination site that was connected to their ad banner, because they wanted to do something that was more consumer focused. So they were with us from the get-go, too. That was a really cool campaign from IBM, by the way.
There was sort of a shortage of web developers, to say the least, in 1994.
Yeah. We were lucky in our building south of Market. Right upstairs was a company called Organic Online, which was a web developer. And I think they ended up doing most of the websites, or at least the kind of the sub-website destinations that our campaigns linked to our customers. So they were getting really busy at that time, and we were so thankful that they were there, because that was kind of the other piece to every campaign that was sold was, oh my gosh, where are we going to link this to? We need a destination here. And not everyone had really thought all that through beforehand.
Right.
So it was definitely a scramble to launch, not so much to get the ad banners ready, because those are pretty simple, but really to get the destinations ready in terms of where these ad banners were going to link to.
So your first clients were Volvo, Club Med, IBM, MCI, which had two campaigns, Zima. Do you recall any of the other early pioneers?
Yeah, we had a campaign from Sprint, and Sprint was handled at that time by J. Walter Thompson in San Francisco. So Sprint came on board. We had a couple of companies as well that have since been acquired. One was the Home Shopping Network. The Internet Shopping Network. Internet Shopping Network, which was later acquired by the Home Shopping Network, but that was called ISN at the time. So that was, this was a pre Amazon, e-commerce play. So Internet Shopping Network was with us. There's a company called Metricom, which was, I don't know what happened to them, but they were their idea was basically to create wireless computer networks by hanging boxes from telephone poles in and around neighborhoods and communities. So that was kind of an idea ahead of its time, kind of ahead of Wi-Fi.
Wow.
I don't even know what the technology was. Yeah.
Sounds like 5G. That's what. If we get 5G, that's what it's going to look like.
Yeah, it was cool. I don't know if it was Wi-Fi or if it was RF or exactly what the signal was. I just can't remember now, but it was super innovative. So you know, we had a couple of those kind of, you know, what at the time, and I think ISN also was kind of a Silicon Valley darling, you know, at the time, and certainly I think Metricom was as well. So these were kind of interesting little companies that got involved with Hotwired at launch, in addition to these, you know, mega, you know, global brands that were participating too. So it was a nice mix.
So you got your early adopters,
yeah,
and then other companies started waking up and saying that they would test the waters. Now, I remember, and this, I might even have a copy of this somewhere in my messy archives, that you probably published a lot of stuff, but I remember you published very early on a guide to online marketing by Hotwired, and one of the things that you tracked was, I guess it was click-through rates. Yeah, it must have been. Click-through rates for your clients. And that must have been a revelation for people in the ad industry, because previous to that, there really wasn't an easy way to measure, okay, we had this many impressions, here's how many actions were taken as a result of those impressions.
Yeah, we did. Those were on the standard reports. And so we would issue a delivery report weekly to our advertisers. And it would include and these were super simple reports. So, I mean, this, we're talking about one sheet, but it would include the page views to their ad. And then we would also include the clicks on their ad. And then we would convert that to a click-through rate. So, you know, which is really the percentage of the clicks versus the views. And so those three data points we published out to our advertisers. So if you think about it, unintentionally, I think at that time, we were basically defining three terms that became and still are commonly used in the industry: page view, click, and click-through rate. And what the reports consisted of. And you know, what was amazing at that time was that the click-through rates were staggeringly high. And by that I mean 50% or even higher wasn't uncommon. And you touched on earlier the bandwidth limitations of the time, which were real. Like the web was slow, and it was a painful experience sometimes to view, particularly if you were on a modem. And, you know, our pages, we tried to make our pages as light as possible, but also it's a graphical medium. So, you know, we did have images and otherwise that took a little longer to load. So to have a 50% or higher click-through rate in a medium that was super slow to experience was pretty amazing. But I think that, you know, in retrospect, I think back on that, and I really think that, you know, most of the people who were experiencing Hotwired at the time were industry insiders. They were either, you know, investors, or they had their own, you know, website, you know, in, you know, built or in mind, and were looking for, you know, to get insight on how to monetize that. Certainly, you know, businesses, you know, VCs more broadly. And so I think kind of everyone I suspect who was clicking on the ads were thinking about, you know, okay, what are the implications of this for our business and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I think that's what kind of drove it at that time. I think it's fascinating to think about that, you know, we launched in October of 94 with paid advertisers, and that year, you know, our revenue was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000. And, you know, I think we were probably had almost 100% market share of the advertising dollars in 1994, online ad dollars in 1994. But InfoSeek didn't launch until the following May or June of 95 with advertising. Yahoo, I don't think their advertising launched until November of 95. So if you think about that, I mean, we're literally a year in advance of Yahoo beginning to monetize their inventory with advertising. So it was super early days. But I think that, you know, back to the click-through rates, it was people who worked for those companies like that, that I think were doing a lot of the poking around and just trying to sort out what was happening with the advertising and how they might incorporate it on their own site.
And if I remember correctly, there was a bit of social unrest over the idea of ads on the internet at all. Do you remember any of that? Where people were at some certain segments of society were outraged by the idea of seeing advertising on the internet.
I think we were certainly sensitive to that. And I mean, I think if I think back on, you know, the bandwidth constraints that you talked about were real. And, you know, even if you wanted a broadband connection, and at the time, you know, you'd have to call the phone company and they'd come and install a T1. That was the T1. You know, kind of the T1 T1 was the starting point for broadband at the time. But, you know, that was a single T1 was going to cost you a couple thousand a month. And so outside of companies and universities, you know, it really wasn't affordable for, you know, your typical home user to have a T1 into their house. And so, you know, modems were the game then. And so, you know, it was so slow. And so, you know, as a result, we were super sensitive about the ad sizes, and not just, and certainly the dimensions. Like, we didn't want the dimensions to overwhelm the page, but that was largely driven by the file sizes. And we didn't want the ads to be too large because we didn't want to slow people's experience. And, you know, there was a great sensitivity to that at Hotwire to, you know, obviously, you know, somebody has to pay for the content, and we're not charging a subscription fee. And, but yet, you know, we wanted to make the ads kind of small and as nimble as possible so they really wouldn't slow the pages, which were already slow enough, as we've already discussed. But I think back now, and I'm actually, it's so unfortunate that had to happen that way, because I still think that ads on the internet are too small. I think the geography assigned to advertising is too limited, and I think that kind of diminishes the communications capability of display advertising in particular. And it really all goes back to the fact that bandwidth was just such a precious commodity at that time, that we just didn't want to abuse it by making the ads much bigger. And so I kind of think that, you know, had the medium not had those bandwidth constraints at the very early stages, I think the advertising online would actually look quite different today.
Yeah, and for, you know, I'm reminded that in 94, I think maybe it changed towards the end of the year, but certainly at the beginning of 94, you had one choice of background color, and it was gray.
Yeah, that's right.
And the typical page would be pretty much text, even though it was a graphical user interface. It was still mostly text. And any kind of graphic of any kind was a big deal. So for people that can't imagine that, imagine it. You know, just putting even the smallest graphic on a web page would cause it to download even that much slower. And there was this divide, you're right, between industry people, many of whom did have T1s running. Now, T1 for people trying to get perspective on what we're talking about standard internet now.
Right.
My home internet, which, you know, isn't costing me hardly anything, I'm getting what the equivalent of T1 speed. But That was only available to industry people, or, you know, people with incredible disposable income, because you're right, it was $1,000, $2,000, but it was another world, and everybody else was sort of crawling. So you had to be so conscious about every little thing you put on the page. Hey, speaking of commerce and stuff, how did you package and sell the first banner ads? Now, of course, they're sold as a commodity. CPM, cost per thousand impressions. What was the original model that you used?
Yeah, so we sold a 12-week sponsorship, and we had 12 channels, and so an advertiser could sponsor a specific channel, and they would own the banner placements throughout that channel for that entire 12 weeks, and we sold it for all of $30,000 back then.
Uh-huh. And
12 weeks for $30,000.
Right, and now on the other hand, I don't know what traffic was like then. There weren't a whole lot of people, certainly relative to today. We're talking about, you know, a few million maybe on the web total, right?
Right.
Web users, you know, now it's billions. So you started with the sponsorship model. How long did the sponsorship model last before people started sharpening their pencils and saying, no, we want to buy impression? And who, do you know who the first person was to say, we're going to sell these by impression?
You know, I have an inclination on that. You know, we didn't know what our audience, we didn't know how large our audience was going to be. So we didn't have any idea. So initially, that's the reason we just sold on straight up sponsorship, because we didn't know. You know, typical advertising deals have some kind of a audience guarantee, if either ratings or impressions, or, you know, whatever the case may be, depending upon the medium. But at the time, since we didn't know, you know, we didn't make that a part of the deal, and advertisers accepted that. I think they felt like the out-of-pocket cost was low, and that it was actually a low risk and a low risk inexpensive way to get some experience with the medium. So we didn't have to at that time, and that made us more comfortable certainly. I think by early 95, though, it started to become clear to us that the CPM, or the cost per thousand, was going to, become the predominant metric in digital advertising, just as it was in other media forms. And so that first came to my attention through a guy named Bill Peck, who had actually worked with us at Wired in the early days. And then in early 95, he went to join InfoSeek as their first ad director and was really developing out their search-based ad model, which then went live, I think, in May of 95. So I think in early 95, Bill came and paid me a visit at Wired, and he shared a little bit about what their plans were. And he said at that time that they were going to sell what was called run-of-site inventory, so non-targeted, for a $20 CPM, and that they were going to sell keyword-targeted campaigns where whatever the keyword or key phrase was in the search would pull a targeted ad based on that term or that phrase, and they were going to sell those at a $50 CPM. So that was their rate card opening in 1995. So that was really the first time another digital publisher had come to me and kind of shared that they were going to be migrating to not only using CPM, but actually leading with CPM as the driving metric by which they would be purchased.
Gotcha. And then also the all-important advance of selling ads related to keywords, which really that's a huge thing. It's funny, when all these things were happening, we were all just sort of doing them because, it was like we're building a house, so we needed to hammer nails here and put that there. But it turned out the things that you guys built is still the structure of this enormous enterprise called the Internet all these 25 years later.
Yeah, keyword targeting was completely revolutionary. And I think, Bill definitely was one of the, early on, really smart guys that had kind of seen the potential of the search engines. There were a number of them at the time. And I think that, like we used at Hotwired, I can't remember which one of them it was, but we used one of the, one of the search technologies at the time. I don't know if it was,
Inkatomi? Was it called?
Yeah, well, we did partner with them later, but they weren't around just yet. It was one of the early ones, but I know InfoSeek's original model, for example, was that they would sell to websites like ours to provide a search capability within our website. And so this idea of giving our users the ability to search our website for things that they'd seen previously or whatever. And so the original search engine model, I think, was more as a search service for web publishers. And I think the ad model actually developed secondarily, once they saw the potential that was there. And I think Bill was really early on seeing that.
Gotcha. Believe it or not, I think it was InfoSeek. I went to a meeting and I was in Mountain View at a high school, and the Department of Treasury had some kind of conference going on. And then as an afterthought on the basketball court, they had a little internet industry trade show. And if I remember correctly, I believe it was InfoSeek. It was definitely a search engine that went on to become huge. And everybody had a card table, literally. And if it was the InfoSeek fellow, he had his PC on the card table as a demo. And the model that he was talking about then was consumers, or was one of the models they were considering, I guess, and he was floating it at this little gathering, was that consumers would buy a package of searches, internet searches, for like $95. And you'd have a certain number of searches. Yeah, this is way, way, way back. Because, for young people and historical researchers, the model right up until 94 was you pay for your online access by the minute.
Right.
And that's what made the internet so incredibly amazing, that, hey, you just plug in and you can go to, not only do you not have to pay by the minute, but you can jump from site to site, because in the old days, every online service was an island. So when you were on CompuServe, you were on CompuServe. You were not even sending email to anybody on Prodigy or AOL. That took a little while to create a universal email delivery system. So the idea that you could suddenly you know, plug in, not pay by the, you know, pay by the month, a flat fee, and then be able to visit any online destination in the universe without having to, you know, turn your modem down and then reboot it up and send it to the right place. I mean, it was really a clunky world. So a lot of that stuff got sorted out in 94. I'm going to propose that 94 was really the year the commercial internet was born, because we had projects like yours and Hotwired's, you know, to actually make a real business on the internet as a publisher, selling ads to real clients. And that did not, again, you know, for people that want to do their historical research, that did not exist pre-Hotwired, other than Global Net Navigator. But again, as I pointed out, that was sort of almost a demo project that O'Reilly, which was one of a great tech publisher, they put up a site and said, hey, let's see what an online magazine would look like. But they didn't really have a lot of energy behind it. So Hotwired was it. And I didn't realize that this month, October, where we're talking in, is actually the 25th anniversary.
Silver anniversary. Here we are.
Yeah. Any recognition anywhere on that to Hotwired or Wired? Or did Wired even notice that they're having a 25th anniversary of this epic? You know?
Yeah.
Their history's been so fast and so full that I think we're not a very historical industry, history-minded industry.
We're not. And Wired has been, the Wired magazine had they're 1 year ahead of Hotwired because of their launch in 93. And so they had a 25th anniversary party last year, and they had a 20th, you know, 6 years ago. So Wired, and I've been going to all of those. So Wired's been hitting the, you know, the 20th and the 25th, and before that, the 10th and so on. I've been going to all of those, as have many, many people from Hotwired and from that time. But yeah, Hotwired has really not adopted that same kind of anniversary model. I know that, you know, one of our early sellers, Doug Weaver, who's gone on to have a great career in digital media, is going to do something in New York City later in October, but that will be a pretty small affair probably. So yeah, not a lot of fanfare for what is really, you know, a pretty big deal.
Yeah, so, you know, anybody who's on the internet, you're on the internet because somebody's figured out how to pay the bills for the various information and service on there, and those bills are being paid for by advertising largely. And that advertising started with Hotwired, and the guy that sold the ads we've just been talking to, Rick Boyce. So some very important internet marketing history that you now know and you can share with your friends. And you have, I think it's important. You know, we know who invented the radio, right? It's funny though, we don't really know who invented the television, which is another odd thing, because television is certainly a dominant thing. But I think if you were to stop 100 people on the street and ask them, well, who invented the television? What was the first TV station? I don't think you'd get many answers. So I guess in this modern age, when these mediums appear so rapidly and become so dominant so fast, we don't even have time to look back. But that's what this call was about, to go back in history and recreate what the era was like and how significant these innovations were. And it's interesting, with every passing year, the significance of what, you know, you guys did at Hotwired becomes more obvious to me, you know, because we really have not, you know, a lot of things have changed and a lot of things have improved, and it's certainly a much bigger audience than it was in 94. But the fundamentals of people coming, clicking on ads, the ads being tracked, people paying for the impressions, that has not changed since October of 1994.
That's true. That is all true.
Yeah. Well, Rick Boyce, thank you so much for sharing this historical recollection with us. And I now have a mystery solved, which is that you were an ad salesman all along. I just hadn't realized that you'd gotten started in college.
True that.
Yeah, I bet that experience really helped break the ice for you throughout your whole career. So since I've addressed young people a lot on this call, when you're in college, do things beyond taking classes, because you're going to find, I know it's been my case and it sounds like it was Rick's case too, that some of the most significant stuff you're ever going to do in college is stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with class, and you never know when it's going to come in handy. And in this case, it became the foundation for the birth of the commercial internet. So thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for looking me up to have this conversation, and thanks for introducing me to the web some 25 plus years ago.
My pleasure, and thanks for not treating me like a lunatic when I was raving about, Rick, it's not going to be 500 channels. It's going to be 5 million channels. What are we going to do with that? And you were so receptive and so encouraging, and that made a huge difference to me, believe me.
Oh, good.
So great. Yeah. Yeah, well, this was
all right,
pleasure.
Ken.
Thanks a lot, and I'll let you get back to life in Marin.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Hey, take care.
You too. Take care. Bye now.